Everybody, I'm Beattie Cohn-Fredos, and welcome again, my friends, to the Ask Beattie Show. And I tell you that it's very, very difficult to feel sad and depressed when you listen to this kind of an opening music. And I think that every day we all need to find things, whether or not it is music or whether or not it is reading or exercising or a combination that really helps us get our spirits up. And of course, for those of you who are tuning into the Ask Beattie Show for the very first time, in fact, it's amazing. I have been doing this show now since 2013. And it's really amazing where the time has gone. I am a psychotherapist, as you all know, and a sex therapist. I'm also the author of the book, For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love. And this is a book I am so, so proud of. I wrote it for my daughter, Jordana. And the book teaches us. It teaches us, of course, if we are open to be taught exactly how to assess who is right for you and who is wrong for you before, yes, not after, but before committing to any serious relationship. Because, of course, the reality is that we are not doing well in the world of our relationships. You know, I talk about this all the time because I give presentations all over the country and also in Canada. And of course, you know that I am Canadian, born in Winnipeg, and I did my graduate and postgraduate work at McGill University in Montreal. And, you know, it is interesting that we have so many therapists and coaches and self-help books and programs about relationships. And yet the truth is that we are continuing to do badly in what I believe, and I know that you probably feel exactly the same way, the most important area in our life. It's not money. It's not business. It's not keeping busy. It's not about the bigger and the better and the more and the upwardly mobile. It is about how can we find and maintain and sustain healthy relationships. And of course, if we're looking at marriage, we have to look at the reality of what's going on in the world of divorce. And 48% of first marriages end in divorce, 67% of second marriages end in divorce. And people are very, very surprised to hear that 74% of couples who are hoping that this time their relationships are going to work to find themselves in the divorce court. And we are looking at very, very high extramarital affairs. And what I've really discovered over the years, and, you know, I look at this as good news. I mean, we can really focus on the depressing statistics, and we can look back at our families of origin, and maybe we were not lucky. And of course, it is the luck of the draw who your parents are going to be. Maybe we were not lucky in having stable, loving families. And yet it really boils down, I believe, at this point in our lives as adults, about what are we going to do about our depression, our anxiety? If we're looking at depression statistics in this country, 17 million adults in the United States suffer from clinical depression. 40 million Americans are suffering from a variety of anxiety disorders. If we look at domestic violence statistics, 4 women are killed every single by their so-called intimate partner. And, you know, I was reading some statistics on suicide, and you may not know that suicide is the 10th leading cause of death here in the United States. And what about teenage dating violence, teenage dating abuse? And these statistics, they may be very surprising to you. And for me, they are extraordinarily upsetting, where you have nearly 1 in 11 females and approximately 1 in 14 male high school students report having experienced physical dating violence in the last year. And only 33% of teens who were in abusive relationships ever told anyone about the abuse. And when asking parents about whether they believe that teenage dating violence or teenage dating abuse was an issue, 81% of parents believe that it is not an issue at all. But there is some really good news that I am starting to see more and more in the media. For example, today in the New York Times, there was a big story in the business section. Therapists are in demand on TV shoots. Look at just a couple of months ago, Naomi Osaka, she had the courage to come out and talk about her need to withdraw from the French Open and also from Wimbledon. And she was very open and honest and courageous to acknowledge that she has been suffering from some serious bouts of depression since the U.S. Open in 2018. So for me, it seems as if mental health and getting help seems to be becoming much, much more mainstream. And it is a good thing, because I don't know about you, but when I was growing up as a little girl, nobody talked about depression or anxiety. And when people talked about psychiatrists, it was usually in the context of somebody who was crazy or in a mental hospital. And I know that some of my own family members would make comments like, well, only rich people go to psychiatrists. But now I think what we're starting to see is that people are being given permission and they are allowing themselves to really acknowledge the issues. I mean, after all, we live in very stressful times, economically and politically. We have people that are so lonely. We've talked so often on the Ask Beattie show about there being a real loneliness epidemic in this country, which was really exacerbated, of course, by the pandemic. And I think that there's only so much time that you can really spend on the computer and trying to connect in that way. But I think that what we've all found is that there is really no substitute for face-to-face, person-to-person connection. So if you are one of these people who has had some long-term depression and or anxiety or other psychiatric problems, or you're having relationship issues or sexual problems, and you're at a point in your life that you really want to finally do something about it. I mean, the good news is that with good therapy, people are able to truly transform their lives and transform their relationships. And in my own practice, I have a private practice here in New York City and also in East Hampton. I would say that the vast majority of the men and also the women that I treat, they call me because of depression or anxiety. Some people have bipolar disorders. Some have substance abuse, sexual abuse, early child sexual abuse issues, and also relationship and sexual issues. But the interesting thing, and I was thinking about this more and more because I've been doing more and more presentations around the country, is that virtually all of my patients, and I think probably, you know, we can put ourselves all into this category as well, have unfinished business and what I call skeletons in our closet from our past, typically beginning with our own family of origin, things that happened in our family, abuse that may have occurred. Perhaps you were in a situation with your parents where there was no love. There was just madness and craziness and disruption. And the reality is, what I have found is that unless these old issues, the skeletons in the closet, the unfinished business, even though we cannot change anything that has happened in our lives, unless these things are emotionally processed as best as they possibly can be, to look at the reality of what happened and what didn't happen. And of course, then being able to make the links, and typically it's very difficult to do this without, you know, being engaged in really good therapy. Because if we're only putting on bandages on the scars and on the wounds, it's very difficult for people then to really live in the present. Because then, if you haven't really gone through the process of looking at what happened and what didn't happen and what did happen and didn't happen and how it affects your current life, you're never quite able to live in the present. And you typically find that people have one foot in the past and one foot in the present. And what I have found also, too, is that unless people really go through this particular kind of a process, that so oftentimes they seem to always be getting in their own way. And I want to tell you about a couple of my patients that I'm currently treating. And of course, I'm changing the names and I'm changing a lot of the details. Let's talk about Sally. Sally is 67 years old. She was in finance for most of her career. In fact, she has had an amazing business career. However, Sally grew up in a very, very abusive family. Her mother was schizophrenic and, of course, was undiagnosed. Nobody in those days talked about seeing a psychiatrist or getting help. And she was virtually beaten almost every single day of her little life. She had a sister who was fortunate. The mother liked her. The father seemed to give her a lot of attention, whereas the father would just sit back and literally encourage and enable the mothers, the verbal beatings, the physical beatings. So what do you think happened to Sally? Well, Sally, she went to some great colleges. She got a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful education, became incredibly successful in her business life. But what do you think happened and has happened to Sally in her personal life? Well, her first husband, she got married when she was 20 years old. She needed to get out of the house as quickly as she thought she could. And she married a man who, what do you think happened? Well, he beat her, if not every single day. He was an alcoholic. So here we have Sally in an emotionally abusive relationship, a physically abusive relationship, which typically has mirrored her early childhood experience when she was growing up. What happened after Sally left her first husband? Well, she met another man. And he was charming and he was wealthy and they shared all kinds of things in common and they had a wonderful, wonderful sex life. However, what really went on behind closed doors? Well, he beat her. He beat her physically. He beat her mentally. He beat her emotionally. They had a child together, and the relationship for over 25 years was yet again a repeat performance of what Sally experienced as a child growing up with her parents and what she experienced in her first marriage. And what was really interesting, I was giving a presentation in East Hampton a couple of months ago. In fact, I'm going to be giving another Never Make a Mistake in Love Again presentation on August the 27th from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the East Hampton Library. And if you actually Google the event, we were hoping that the event was going to be in person, but I suspect if it is, it's also going going to be on Zoom. So Sally saw that I was giving a presentation, and she had been in therapy off and on, according to her, for many, many years, but somehow continued to repeat that original abusive dynamic that she had learned when she was growing up as a little girl. So we began, and you know, she said this time around she was going to be really serious and was willing to go back and look at a truly, truly horrific history. And is it a tea party? And is it fun? Well, it is absolutely none of those things at all. It is extremely, extremely painful. And what has happened, and I've only been working with her for the last couple of months, guess what's happened? Well, she just got out of yet another abusive relationship. It took a couple of weeks for her to realize that here we go again. This was going to be a repeat of her family of origin. It was going to be a repeat of marriage number one and also marriage number two. And she really started to make the links, and she realized how she was continuing to get in her own way. And not only did she leave yet another abusive relationship, she's also started to take a look at her friends and her family. And we are discussing the relationships that are truly healthy relationships. And of course, in all healthy relationships, there's going to be ups and downs. But she has, through this process thus far, been able to realize that many, many of her friends, they were takers. And of course, Sally learned to be a caretaker when she was a little girl. And when she was a little girl, she learned that if she could somehow find a way to keep the peace in her family, that perhaps her mother's craziness would be halted for a period of time, and that she would not be beaten physically as well as emotionally. So she's going through a major, major transformation, and I am so proud of her. And it's hard, hard, hard work. And yet she, at this point in her life, she made a decision. And I think that we all have to make decisions. Sometimes we make them earlier if we're luckier and smarter, and sometimes we make them later. But we need to make decisions about, are we living our lives in ways that are really in our best interest? And of course, that is the homework that I give, the same homework that I give every single patient that I treat after every single session. I want people to be mindful of whether or not they're living their lives and they're navigating relationships in ways that are constructive and healthy, or on the other hand, whether or not they are living their lives in ways that are destructive and self-destructive and self-sabotaging. And, you know, for each of us, we all have to get to a point in our life. And of course, there's some people who never really get to a point in their lives where we're willing to take action, where we're willing to really acknowledge and address and resolve our problems, and to also be able to take an honest look at ourselves and ask ourselves, what is it really? What is it about us that is continuing to go down a really destructive and self-destructive path? And of course, the most important question that people then have to really ask themselves is whether or not they are actually willing to do something about it. And I have another patient, you know, in contrast, that I want to tell you about. This woman is in her early 50s. She too grew up in a very, very mentally, emotionally, sexually, physically abusive home, where her father basically just enabled the mother's beatings. And he would just kind of sit back and he'd say, say, well, you can hit her more. And just kind of watched as this all played out for this this girl's entire childhood. So you can imagine, if you compare Sally, and now we're talking about, you know, my second patient, let's call her Mary. Okay. So what do you think happened to Mary? Well, Mary is brilliant. She has several degrees. She has been extremely successful in her career. And what's oftentimes so interesting is that people who are so damaged and have had such difficult and abusive beginnings oftentimes have been able to really compensate. And, you know, it takes a lot of courage for these people to be able to go off in other directions and do incredibly, incredibly well. Well, Mary has been in therapy with me for a number of years, but has probably been in therapy with one therapist or another for most of her life, beginning during her adolescence. And she has been to the top rehab facilities in the country and has seen the top psychiatrists, and has, she could probably write the book on family of origin trauma. And yet, this is a very interesting situation. Mary's relationships have never changed. Every single relationship that she has been in, and not just with men, but with women as well, have been abusive to a varying degree. And we were talking about this recently, about why she knows this. It's not something that she has not processed. And yet there is something about Mary where the familiarity of being in an abusive relationship, it absolutely transcends any behavior or real desire on her part to extricate these relationships and find people who are going to treat her well. So it is a struggle where you have Sally, who after a couple of months has really gotten it. She's really worked so hard at trying to really move forward on a constructive and healthy path, whereas you have Mary is still very, very much wedded to misery. You know, and I was saying to Mary recently, listen, I need a partner in all of this. At this point, I think I want Mary's life to be much, much better than Mary does her life. So you can see how, you know, different people in different situations have a harder time really being able to change a very, very ingrained kind of a dynamic. But even though Mary and I, we've been, you know, in treatment together now for several years, there is no way that I am going to write this off. And there's no way that I'm planning to give up on Mary, even though she feels that probably, you know, that nothing is going to change in her life. So we continue and we try and find new ways to really encourage somebody to, on a very, very deep level, to begin to realize that they are worthwhile and that they can indeed move into a different kind of path that is constructive and that is really in their best interest. So who has ever said that being a therapist is an easy kind of profession? I mean, I must say that I absolutely love what I do, and the challenges with everybody that I treat, they are unique and they are really great. Well, I'm going to do something a little different for the second part of the show today. I've been getting a lot of emails and questions from listeners and from people just at large, and they're curious about my background, my educational background, my life. So what I decided to do is that I was going to ask my husband, who is the love of my life, Jim Bredos, who is a sociologist, and he is also the host of an amazing show, The Radical Imagination, on MNN. It plays at different times on different days, and it is definitely a show that you really do need to watch. And so I decided that I was going to ask him to interview me and really give you, my listeners and colleagues and friends, some information about me as a person and as a professional that you may not know, and that yet you have asked me to share with you. So, honey, it's good to have you here again.
It's
here.
It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you so very, very much for sharing your time. And of course, as you said, so many of your listeners are interested in who Beattie really is deep down, and how you chose to become a psychotherapist and a sex therapist, and what led you to that, and what about your early background, your early life? Because, I mean, that's quite a career, quite a profession to choose at such an early age as you did. I mean, why do people do that? Why did you decide? What was going on in your background and experience growing up in Canada that got you started on this wonderful career and profession of yours?
Well, certainly as a child, I mean, I obviously didn't know anybody who was a therapist or a psychiatrist. I grew up in an Orthodox Jewish family in Winnipeg, Canada. My mother was a teacher. And my father was a writer, and he did some farming. But what was a turning point for me, and I will never forget this, when I was maybe 10 years of age, it was Hanukkah, and my birthday in Hanukkah in December came about at the same time of the year. And my mother bought me a white transistor radio. Now, and I was just enthralled. I mean, in those days, having a transistor radio was a really big deal. And I would take it to bed with me and I would listen to music. And how I discovered this show, Ask the Pastor, I will never know. Jim, it was on at midnight every single Sunday night.
Once a week.
And the host was, and I can still remember his name, and I actually met him when I was an adult, Pastor Eglin, and it was a call-in counseling show. And people would call in with their problems, their marriage problems, and their relationship issues. And I was beyond. And here I am. I mean, little Beattie is 10 years old, and I am listening to this, Jim.
What was his credentials? Was he?
He was a minister.
So he didn't have, wasn't.
I
trained as a psychologist.
I have no idea.
And
it would be fun to maybe Google that. No, but his show ran for years, and he was a wonderful talk show host. And the show, it was an hour show, and I could not get enough of this show.
It was a call-in show.
And from there, I would read in the Winnipeg papers, Dear Anne and Dear Abby. I read every single advice that they would give the people who wrote in. So for me, Jim, there was never a decision to be made. I wanted a call-in counseling show. I wanted to be Anne Landers and Dear Abby, and I was the girl on my street growing up on Byrne Avenue in Winnipeg that everybody came to discuss their problems.
But let me ask you, within the Orthodox Jewish community, was there physicians, psychiatrists at all, or was there interest in the community in therapy or
I have no idea. I'm sure that there were psychiatrists. There had to have been, but it was never
ever a subject that was ever talked about. Nobody ever talked about depression. Nobody ever talked about anxiety or alcohol abuse. It
but
never
you
came up.
Picked it up within the community, within the your family, visitors.
No,
no,
not at all. It was the radio show. I wanted
to perform in a sense.
Well, I just thought, I guess performing, sure, which is something I suppose I've done all my life on the tennis courts and on the skating rinks. But no, it was the idea that people would express their feelings about their problems. And that there was someone there, this pastor, and of course, dear Anne and dear Abby, that would be able to help people acknowledge, address, and resolve their problems. And, you know, it's
fortunate for you to have.
Well, it was the most natural thing. And then my little friends would come and they would ask me all kinds of questions about boys. I mean, what did I know about boys? What did I know about relationships?
So what did you tell them? How do you made up things or you did? You went to the.
I'm not sure.
Wrote letters to Dear Abby or you did research?
No, of course I didn't. I think I had in that arena. I think I always had, maybe not so much for myself. I think I had good common sense.
Okay.
And it was a natural progression that I was going to become a therapist. I mean, at one point I was thinking of becoming a trial lawyer because yes, I did like to perform and I did like to help people. But when I finished my undergraduate training, I mean, there was never a question that I was going to become a therapist.
Now, okay, it's one thing to be needed and helpful to all your wonderful little friends there and in the community, girls and boys would, right? The boys would come up and be sort of confused and it was more the girls.
I'm actually, you know, as you're asking me this question right now, there are two,
because within the Orthodox community there's sort of a separation there, right?
Well,
or not a strict
in my world it was more modern Orthodox, boys and the girls, and we were together. And of course I went to an Orthodox school, the Talmud Torah in Winnipeg. But no,
with boys and girls going in the same class.
Yes.
Oh, okay, good.
Yes.
Okay, so
but I don't think there were boys that came to me, maybe, you know, on occasion to ask about advice about girls.
Why not?
It didn't happen.
Yeah, but why do you think it didn't happen? You naturally.
Because boys at that point, and although it's changing now, I mean, they didn't express their feelings about love and worry and depression and moods and anxiety.
You know, I sure would have asked you a few questions. Absolutely.
Well,
but anyway, okay. But listen, okay, now this is all fine and good, but being a psychotherapist, enormous responsibilities. I mean, this is not a piece of cake here. You're dealing with people's existence, their lives, their deepest feelings. I mean, this is a pretty heavy thing to go into, particularly at an early age.
It is very, very serious business. And I had an opportunity before I did my graduate and postgraduate degrees at McGill. I mean, people have heard me say I have postgraduate specialization in marriage and family therapy and sexual dysfunction. I've had a lot of training and I am so grateful for the training that I received at McGill, because people have heard me say a lot, you know, all therapists are not the same. All psychotherapy is not the same. And how careful people have to be when it comes to choosing their therapist.
But what about life experience? I mean, come on now. It's how much can somebody absorb, the teenager, early 20s? I mean, as you know, I had a fantastic therapist and a psychiatrist who was, I guess, starting in his 50s. And I was always more comfortable with an older therapist. I mean, there's a certain amount of life experience one needs to have to a certain extent, right?
It's no.
And how can one get that in such an early age?
You can't. And when I first started off before my graduate training, I started off working in residential treatment centers for adolescent girls. Right. And these were girls who had been abused in a variety of different ways. So they were not living at home. They were living in a residential setting. And there was something about that whole environment. I realized, and of course I had supervision at the time, that they needed somebody to talk to. They needed to have a safe environment where they could express their feelings. So it was in that way, Jim, I wasn't doing heavy duty, serious psychodynamic type of therapy, but I was there as a person who over time that they were able to talk to and trust.
But also you gained a depth of understanding of the human condition. And right. I would go back a little bit to your mother and father. Uh-huh. I mean, who may have not talked as about therapy much or
ever,
but they also experienced things in their life, in their history, in their ancestry, pretty heavy duty stuff. Now they may not have talked about it much, but somehow you must absorb that too.
Well, it was never talked about, but my mother was a teacher and her students, they loved her. And my mother was not an emotional kind of a woman. And yet she was able to connect with students to this day who still remember Edith Sayre as their teacher. Whereas for me, it was my father who was the emotional parent. And even though we didn't sit and talk about depression and anxiety and substance abuse, I was able to be very, very open emotionally with my dad. And he was very accepting. If I was feeling upset or if I hadn't been invited to a party, I would be able to sit down and talk with him.
Absorbed their history and their pain and their struggle. Too, even though your mother may not have been emotionally out there about it, but you must have had some curiosity in picking up, gosh, why is she in a way so shut down? What did that? Anyway, this gets.
But those are such great questions. Yeah, but as a child, I never thought about any that at all. I mean, I would have liked a mom who had been really more emotionally available, although she was amazing in other ways. I mean, I had every possible lesson and you know, she made sure that I had, you know, great clothes and that I did all kinds of activities. I never thought about that until later.
But by her example, in a sense, in that interaction, you did gain a sort of knowledge about people who, to a certain extent, were repressed, let's say.
Absolutely.
It's an interesting, fascinating family dynamics and community dynamics here. But gosh, there's so many questions we want to get to, so many things that people are interested in. But go ahead.
But I want people to really understand that, as you said, Jim, I mean, this is serious business.
Absolutely.
And you really have to know what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And experience is very, very important. And the kind of therapy that I did in my 20s is very, very different than, you know, the kind of therapist that I am, you know, 35 years later. And my own life experience really very much has factored into, you know, who I am, not only as a woman and a wife, but also as a therapist. So people have to be very, very careful when they decide to go into therapy. I've written many articles on, you know, how to find a therapist, and you can actually Google, and you can just, you know, Google my name, Bede Cohn-Fredos, and how to find a therapist. Another recent article that I wrote is your therapy helpful or harmful? Because people don't know. The consumer doesn't know. And we have to do our homework when it comes to who we let into our lives personally, in our business relationships, and also if we're looking for therapy or a therapist.
Sure, a patient has to understand, well, who am I now? Who am I letting into my life?
Exactly.
And on a tightrope here, on the edge that I am. And that goes for you too. In a sense, you're in a position you have to remain somewhat objective and to a certain extent detached, correct?
I'm not detached. I'm definitely not a detached person.
No, that's true.
Or a therapist. And, you know, I'll tell you about a young boy, a new patient who was referred to me. This is a young boy who's 13 and who had been abused very, very badly by his biological mother, sexually, physically, mentally, emotionally. And he had seen a number of therapists, and he was now living with his biological father and stepmother. And it was really interesting. I needed to wait. I saw him for the first time last week. Mm-hmm. To see where did he want to sit. I wanted him to feel comfortable. There was a table, there was a chair, there was a sofa, you know, in our house. Mm-hmm. And I needed to make sure that he felt comfortable to take that first step. And for about the first 45 minutes, Jim, he wouldn't look at me at all. He was, you know, recounting the abuse. He was so honest and so courageous and so lovely. He was talking about the abuse that he had sustained over his entire childhood and how the courts had let him down and the guidance counselors had let him down and that people knew what was going on and that nobody did anything. And it was the second hour. It was, you know, we were at our home in East Hampton. And I needed to talk to his parents. So I said, do you mind if you just, you know, just go outside for a little while? I want to have a quick chat with your parents. And he came back. And then I wanted to have a chat with him for the rest of the second hour. So he said to me, and this was just so great. He said, can we go outside? And we have a hammock. And we sat on the hammock and we sat, you know, there was distance, but he was able to look at me. And he was continuing. I mean, we could have talked for 10 hours recounting what went on. And this is a boy who's had, you know, extreme trauma, and this is not going to be a short-term kind of a therapeutic experience. There was a breakthrough.
There was
a breakthrough. It was amazing. And I had said to him, I said, you know, you've been seeing this other therapist from the court, you know, for quite some time. And he said, well, he said, you know, she just asks me how I'm feeling. So it was like, okay, I'm going to ask you how you're feeling too, but there's just so much. There's a way to engage with
people. And engage the person so that they know that you really, really care.
Right.
And that's so important. In any good relationship, in and out of therapy.
Right.
And that's the one other question to ask here is, what makes for the difficulty, the challenge of having healthy relationships? Why are we having so much trouble as a people, as individuals, as a culture?
It's not a subject that people really talk about.
I mean, with any great
no
depth, but we're all interested in it.
We're interested, and we continue to miss the boat. I mean, I know you've heard the statistics that I recount every single week about the divorce rates, about the extramarital affairs, about domestic violence. And I mean, when I go around the country and I am sharing good news, and people who know me and you know me, I'm very bottom line. If there is not good news to share, let's not waste anybody's time. And there are the three things that people actually need to do to never make a mistake in love again, or to not have people, if we're not even talking about romantic relationships, to not have toxic people in our lives. And, you know, when I was talking about some of the patients that I'm currently treating who came from terribly, terribly abusive backgrounds, and how they continued to repeat that cycle because it's what they knew, and it was, you know, still something that they very felt comfortable in, you know, comfortable in quotes, you know, being engaged.
There was no alternative. They didn't see different possibilities.
They didn't even know. They didn't even on a conscious level realize that what they were doing was repeating history, which is why, you know, when I talk about the three things that we all need to do, each of us needs to be in a good place emotionally and psychologically and psychiatrically as best as we can, and to work through, even though we can't change history, what did and did not happen in our family of origins, so that we have clarity. Like my patient, Sally, I'm so proud of her. You know, she went from a terribly abusive relationship with her parents into yet another abusive marriage, into a second abusive marriage. And then she saw an opportunity when she, you know, saw an advertisement that I was giving this presentation at the East Hampton Library on Never Make a Mistake in Love Again. And she made a decision at age 67 that there needed to be a better way to live. And she works so hard at this.
It does take time, doesn't it, to become or transform a person, to heal, to absorb this. I know that you, it varies from patient to patient. And
time.
You have to calibrate. You have to try to figure out, well, what can I, how much to push this and how much not. It's a very nuanced relationship that you've been establishing, that you establish with each and every patient that is different.
Right. And, you know, it's true. And you have to be very aware of how quickly to go, how much to push, how much to withdraw in certain ways from, you know, you're wanting somebody to move forward. You're wanting them to, you know, take on this new task. And yet readiness is so important. And this is, it's an art. This is not just about knowing a variety of different theoretical orientations. Mm-hmm. I mean, being a therapist, being a really good therapist, it's like being an artist.
It is.
And everybody is different.
You're helping to create, in a sense, a new and healthier person who can have healthier and better relationships. Hopefully.
Right. And live a healthier and better quality of life across the board.
And yet we hear a lot of dissatisfaction of those in therapy, or it doesn't, for some, it doesn't really help that much. And what do you, is that again, picking the wrong therapist, or we're not giving people enough of what they need within the therapeutic process?
I think you have to be ready. For somebody who's thinking about therapy, I mean, readiness is really important. And seriousness.
That's,
I mean, that's the first question that I ask people when they call me. Are you serious? If somebody's not serious, I really don't want to work with them. You know, so there has to be a real level of seriousness and a commitment. And this only happens, what I have found over all these years, is when life is bottoming out, when there is a crisis. There has never been a time ever when somebody calls me and says, "Beatty, I need help with communication and problem solving." It never, ever, ever happens. Everything is falling apart. There's crises all around the people. And it's at that point, that crisis, you know, which I've always felt can become a real opportunity, is when people make the call. Now, is there going to be the follow through? Well, it depends. It depends. I mean, I'm a very active therapist. I'm a very interactional therapist. So if somebody is wanting a therapist in the old psychoanalytic way, where you're just going to sit there and talk about your dreams and just really be removed, I am the wrong therapist for that kind of a person who would like that kind of therapy.
But even though you do go into early childhood experiences.
Always.
And dreams are at times very, very interesting to understand what's going on in the present. But,
right.
But, yeah, you know, we have so many questions. Let me turn and lump it all together in a
way.
You're a sex therapist. Now, that is an area which does pique a lot of people's interest.
What does she do?
What do you do? But people's, interest in you personally, but also, of course, in their own lives. So does that mean that there has to be this crisis also in one's sexual life or just perhaps. Yeah. And that can be defined in a variety of ways. Lack of knowledge, repression, et cetera, right? So
it's a very, you know, it's hard to really maybe take this all in, but sex is still a very difficult subject for the majority of people to talk about with themselves as well as with their partners.
Why do you think that's so? In an American culture, which is in many ways so titillating, and we have all kinds of, you know, pornography out there and soft porn and so on. At the same time, we do have a strong Puritan streak.
I think very, very much so. I mean, I see many couples who rarely, if ever, have sex, and they have difficulty even talking about it. And people are rushing off in 1,000 different directions. And you couple that with income pressures and child pressures and fatigue and lack of sleep and relationship and issues.
And yet there is still the interest. There's the needs. There's this and that and physiologically and so on. So does that explain in part the rising rates in divorce and infidelity and porn sites and so on and so on?
Well, you mentioned the porn sites. So, of course, preparing for this interview, I did a little bit of research. So active pornography users, 46 to 74% of men, according to some recent studies, and the studies seem pretty solid studies, are active pornography users.
What age groups?
Didn't look at the breakdown, could and should. 16% to 41% of women are
now
also,
the women. Okay, so the wait a minute.
Yes.
Say that again. So the men, what?
46 to 74% of men.
What was the men, women?
16 to 41.
Okay.
Percent.
All right.
And Pornhub, which is a major, major porn site, they have reported over 39 billion searches and 42 billion visits during 2019.
That's around the world.
Suggesting 115 million visits per day.
Per day. And break that down for me. Well, okay. So, yeah. So here you have a situation where there's a lot of people using that as a vehicle.
Yes.
And
yes.
Not really relating. Well, now let me ask this too. Can you, as a therapist, use these porn or pornography as a vehicle to enhance one's sexuality with another person?
If people are comfortable, I mean, my feeling is anything goes as long as you are not putting yourself at risk or your partner at risk, whatever it is that turns you on. I mean, I was a spokesperson for a sex toy company, actually for a couple of sex toy companies, and they sent me, as you know, boxes and boxes of vibrators, which, you know, I tried, and very, very recently a patient of mine who has never had an orgasm in her life, and she is in her late 60s, we were talking about sex, and she has a boyfriend, which is terrific. And they are starting, and he's, you know, a little bit younger, and they are starting to, she says, fool around. So I gave her one of my many, many, many vibrators that I will never use. And she sent me an email over the weekend, and they used the vibrator.
All
and
right.
She had an orgasm.
All right. Well, look.
And so excited.
Yeah.
Now, of course, most therapists are not giving their patients vibrators, but I really had so many, you know, so many of these boxes. I mean, there was only so many vibrators
that
I could try.
The breakthrough.
Well, it did. So and she was so excited. You know, she's coming in tomorrow, and she's going to tell me about all the details. But
and she's going to want to have other maybe toys or all kinds of things to explore.
So, well,
you've opened up this whole new world and life that, again, emotional and physical and sexual parts of us that's so important, because Gestalt, the totality of the person is dealt with here, as in therapy, as I think it should be. Mm-hmm. So yeah, oh gosh, are there things that you'd like to mention here that we haven't really covered? I know down to a few more minutes?
We are actually down to a few more minutes, and I'm hoping that the microphone issue is working. I've just actually got a chat from the Progressive Radio Network studio. I'm hoping that interview actually is going to be...
If not, we'll do it again.
Well, I guess we will do it again. But I guess in closing, for people, I think that the very best thing that people can do if they are having, whether it's sexual issues or emotional issues or relationship issues, and if you're finding that the exercise and the diet and all of these other things are really not helping to resolve problems that continue to get in the way of your life and your relationship. I'm hoping that after all these years that I have convinced people to really give themselves permission to reach out and ask for help.
Not just to you too. I mean, you too as well. No, but we need time. You need time for us. And then I'm teasing you.
No, definitely. Well, last week I took a mental health day and it was great.
Busy there, that's wonderful. No. Listen, thank you again so very much.
Well, listen, thank you. And I'm hoping that this interview, I will check and see. I'm hoping that it actually, went through production-wise. And I want to leave everybody with my two weekly messages. And, of course, the first message, and I'm hoping that, in listening to this conversation, that you really have been able to take this in, is to do everything that you need to do to find ways to love yourself and really be mindful of living life in all ways that are really in your best interest. And secondly, of course, we all need to do a much, 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 much better job in learning to respect each other and love each other despite our differences.
Thank you for so much for being the love of my life.
Well, and you are the love of my life. And again, we will have you back
continued.
At
yes,
some point to be continued. And again, I wish everybody a good rest of the day. Be well, take care of yourself, and we'll talk soon. And of course, tune in live every Monday afternoon from 3 to 4 Eastern Standard Time, right here on the Progressive Radio Network for the Ask Beattie Show. So be well, hugs and kisses, everybody. Bye-bye.